This is John Shannon with Radio Free Galisteo. Today we have a blast from the past in that the interview you're going to hear with Woody Gwynn, who is a Galisteo resident and internationally and nationally renowned painter, happened pre-pandemic. Here's part one of that interview. It's safe to say that painter Woody Gwynn is a Santa Fe treasure, a New Mexico treasure, and arguably a national treasure. He's the winner of multiple awards, and his work can be found across the country and all over the world. I was lucky enough to speak with him the other day in his home, along with two companions, Denise Lynch and Matthew Higginbotham, both of whom are regional artists. In the first part of the interview, Woody tells us how he came to be in Galisteo. Woody, how did you land here in Galisteo?
I first came to New Mexico in 1973, and I bought a house in Cerrillos for $27,000. It's still there, of course. It sold recently for about $400,000. But, of course, I knew about Galisteo. And, well, one reason I moved to New Mexico is I wanted to be around other artists, and there was already a group of people out here in Galisteo. There were a lot of people in Cerrillos at the time, but and they did, you know, creative work, I guess you could say. It was an interesting experience in Cerrillos. I had the only telephone and the only working bathtub, and the person who owned the property before me had been generous about letting people come and take baths and, you know, use the telephone. So, I don't know, let's put it this way. I got to know a lot of people, you know, in Cerrillos. But Paul Sarkisian was there, and that was great getting to know him. He was doing realism at that time, which is what he really became famous for. What can I say? I wanted to meet artists, and as far as Galisteo goes, like I say, there were a lot of artists out here. And when I decided to move to New Mexico full-time, I found a place here in the village and got it. So that's sort of how it happened, you know. What can I say? At that time, I still am a big fan of a number of artists that had lived here and were still living here, like Georgia O'Keeffe. I loved her. I still love her work.
And, is Agnes here then?
Well, no, she didn't come till later. I moved here, then she moved next door to me. So that was kind of interesting.
And we're talking about Agnes Martin.
Agnes Martin, yes. But the Sarkisians, it was great to know them because Carol was George O'Keefe's. She was a seamstress, and she made O'Keefe's clothes. And so one time, O'Keefe's maid put one of her outfits in the washing machine with bleach and ruined it. And so she was in she came to the Sarkisians, and then after they'd measured her and whatnot to replace the clothes, they brought her over to meet me in Cerrillos. And so that was a great experience. So I didn't so much, you know. So I came here to meet people like that because in Texas, well, you know, I didn't really know that many people who were that serious about being artists.
You're from Texas originally.
Yes, I have to be careful about it, owning up to that, you know.
Aww.
Yeah, you know, Tejano is, you know, like calling, you know, it's really sort of a pejorative around here. You can understand why, I guess. But, well, you know, the Republic of Texas claimed everything east of the river, and it only lasted 4 years. So by the time the news got up here, it was all changed again. So
you started in Texas, but you went to the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts.
Yes, I did, and that was because when I was 18, I knew I wanted to be an artist, but I knew I just I have a regressive gene when it comes to math. And back then, you couldn't go to a college or university unless you took math courses, and it would have been a hopeless situation. So anyway, I went and I phoned up Peter Hurd. There I was living in Midland, Texas, and I think he thought I was a rich oil man. Oh, yes, Mr. Gwynn, come out tomorrow at 3 o'clock. That'll be great. And so I drove out to the ranch, and I don't know, I must have presented a pretty, well, I don't know what I looked like, but he said, like right now I'm an El Greco, but back then I was a Giacometti.
Well said.
What's that?
That's well said.
Yes, because he looked at me, he said, well, you know, I was a waif once myself. Anyway, he couldn't have been nicer, and the poor man and his wife were stuck with me because a big snowstorm came in. It was in February. So I spent the day out there, and you know, and he gave me some very, for the time, radical advice. He said, look, if you want to be an artist, he said, the only time I feel like I've wasted was the 2 years that I went to Haverford College in Pennsylvania. Well, that was pretty radical talk for 1962. Now it's not, really.
It's really come around.
Yeah. Well, anyway, he said, if you really want to be an artist, he said, go to an art school and, you know, expose yourself to other people who are real serious about doing art and, you know, the competition and so on and so forth. And he said, I went to the Pennsylvania Academy in Philadelphia. So that was in February, and in April I was driving to Pennsylvania. Yeah. And the interesting thing was, again, I've had these accidental things happen all my life. I'd bought from an oil man in Texas for $2,500 a Lincoln Continental Mark II. And we'd see him driving around town, shaving, you know, in the car. And anyway, for some reason, he got tired of having it and decided to sell it. And so I bought it.
That was a lot of car.
It was, you know, and had a hood, you know, it was, I don't know, 8 or 9 feet long, and a Continental kit in the back. And well, anyway, people said, oh, you can't go out to the, you know, to art school and driving that thing. No one will take you seriously. Well, but I didn't have any other kind of car, so I drove on out there.
Were there any suggestions on what kind of car you should have?
No, there really weren't. But the interesting thing was I found a room at the, I wanted to see Chad's Ford, Pennsylvania, because the Herd's brother-in-law, Andrew Wyeth, had one of his houses there. And there was an inn there, and the lady there, on the inn, had rooms upstairs, and she charged $10 a week. So I decided, well, I'll just live here. It wasn't that far from Philadelphia. Well, so here was this skinny kid from Texas driving this Mark II Lincoln Continental. Well, it turned out that Andrew Wyeth had a Mark II Lincoln Continental. And so he couldn't wait to talk to me because he was having mechanical problems with his car, and I was the same ones. The Continental Mark II didn't have one muffler. It had three on each side, six mufflers. So you were turning it on, and it was like you were floating around in a cloud. And he was having trouble with his, they were called resonators. So, you know, we were able to commiserate right off the bat. And anyway, it turned out to be a great, you know, even when I went to find a studio there, there was a tinsmith shop, and I went to talk to an old tinsmith. I have a drawing of it around here somewhere. And the lady that owned it looked at me and said, well, I know that it's hard getting started in your profession. She was a friend of Wyeth's. She said, even if your father is a rich Texas oil man. I didn't tell her that my father was a locksmith and that you could buy keys from him for 25 cents a piece, but I just let them think what they wanted to think, which is basically my attitude now, too. That was that experience, you know.
So that was a pretty decent start to your time in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, you know, right now it all has a dreamlike quality to it because Wyeth's sister, whose name was Carol, she was an artist, and her mother, Mrs. N.C. Wyeth, who was a wonderful, wonderful person. She was still alive and as, you know, sharp as a... Anyway, they didn't have a car, and the rest of the family was up in Maine. So here I was, and I decided to take classes from Carolyn. Well, I had a car, and one like Andy's, in fact. So they had me drive them into Philadelphia and Wilmington and places like that, that was great. You know, they couldn't have been nicer. And Carolyn was extremely eccentric. You know, she would sit in a chair with her legs apart and not wear any underwear, things like that, you know.
And this was when? What year?
1963. Oh, yeah.
Exciting times.
Yeah, you know. And she wore a black gaucho hat. And anyway, she stood out in the crowd. She was a character. And anyway, that's how I got started.
All right. And how long were you there? What was the course?
Just a couple of years. And I took classes at the Pennsylvania Academy, like you said. And I was going to sign up for more time there, but the head of the instructors was a man named Francis Spate. He had a very strange way of talking, but he would sort of like start a sentence and then be quiet for a long time. And then he would finish it, you know. And he said, you know, you can already draw, and there's really not much more we can teach you here.
You're listening to part one of Radio Free Galisteo's interview with artist and Galisteo resident Woody Gwynn. You can support Radio Free Galisteo at www.patreon.com/Radio Free Galisteo.
Anyway, so I went back to Texas and, you know, I painted. I've always been a landscape painter. And I'm old now, and I've seen all of these, you know, isms come and go. And I've never really been a part of any crowd. I figured that you come in with a crowd and you go out with a crowd.
A friend of mine recently said that your realism is actually touches on the abstract.
Well, if the thing doesn't work on the abstract level, then it's not any good, really. You should be able to turn it upside down and still have an interesting thing to look at, hopefully even an exciting thing to look at. One of the reasons I like O'Keefe's abstractions is that they seem, most of them anyway, rooted in reality. And I think that's what gives them the power that they have. One of my favorite pieces of hers, it was at the O'Keeffe Museum a couple of years ago. I can't remember. It's black abstraction and has this little point of a light in it. It's in the Museum of Modern Art. And it came when she was going under the surgery in the 30s. She put her arm up against her face and so the line in the painting is actually her inside of her arm, and the white dot was the light over the operating table receding away from her. Well, it's an abstract painting, but you can sense that it's really based on a powerful experience. So I like abstraction that's based on realism or reality, and I like realism that is rooted in abstraction.
So I'm going to deviate briefly from that form of art and ask you about Carlos Castaneda.
Carlos Castaneda? Have you ever read any of his books?
I am going to admit that I have not. Well, however, it's been recommended to me that I ask you about it.
Well, I mean, just read the first one. You don't have to bother with the rest. They get crazy. I mean, I don't care if he saw a 100-foot mosquito or, you know, but the first book where he meets this, where the author, Carlos Castaneda, he was a psychologist, an anthropologist from Los Angeles. He met this brujo, I guess would be the Spanish word, whose name was Juan Malthus, and Juan really talked to him about his philosophies, and it's all in the first book, which I think is called Journey to Ixalan or something like that, isn't it? Yeah. And then there are four or five others, but they really sort of, you know, the first one's the best one, and I think gives you all you need.
You know, you having read that, has that influenced your art? Or did you find it was just aligned with what you were doing anyway?
Well, I think it's interesting philosophically to, you know, anybody doing anything, you know. I mean, I remember Denise quoted this a day or so ago, but one of the things that Juan Malthus emphasized with Carlos Castaneda was life is about balancing the terror of being alive with the wonder of being alive. And he said, that's what I've done, Carlos. And to follow the path that has heart, and that's what I've done. And so each step I take breathlessly, you know, because everything is fresh and new when you're looking at it through that perspective. He was sort of, you know, popular, especially with hippies and everything back in the 70s, but he was very elusive. I know one journalist was... He was on Time magazine, but he had his face covered up with his hands. I mean, that was a cover shot of him, you know. So, but one journalist had gone down to Columbia, I think where he was from, and she had really dug into his past to try to find out something about him, and because he was, like I say, very elusive. And she said, you know, you tell people that your mother, you were 14 when your mother died. Mr. Castaneda, and I found out from the records down there that you were 24. And he said, well, the truth about your mother has nothing to do with the facts, which I think is an interesting thought. He was interesting. What can I say? And, you know, right now, you know, we've gone on to other things. And he was pretty big, too, whenever I moved out here with the... You know, there was quite a hippie scene, you know, in Cerrillos. I mean, it was incredible, really. They had taken over the whole village, and you know, people would go to the post office and horrify the postmistress. I think her name was Alice Lopez. Well, anyway, they would go with no clothes on and things like that, you know. It was a great time. It was tail end of the so-called hippie era. But Paul was there, and Paul's, you know, a very serious artist. And Carol was we lost her a couple of years ago, unfortunately. But she was a great lady, and so getting to know them was a shot in the arm. For the first time, I saw really close up somebody who was very passionate about making things. You know, making things. I met other people, of course, before that, but I didn't get to know them as well as I got to know Paul.
You have a show starting on the 26th of July at the Lou Allen Galleries. What can you tell us about it?
Well, like I say, I'm just an old-fashioned realist painter, really, and as a result, I think it seems like a lot of people around here. Well, I don't know. It's not just around here. I think we're in a strange period. I think the art world, I think the word art has been, you know, kidnapped. And
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, I don't know. It's like, you know, Duchamp saying, oh, well, I'm an artist. And if you're an artist and you say it's art, well, then it's art. Well, you know, I think that's... what was that song of? It ain't necessarily so, you know. I mean, the culture is much older than ours, like the Hindu culture, thousands of years old. Well, in Sanskrit, they have a definition of art. You know, it's not just anything you want it to be. Oh, I'm going to dig a hole in the desert, and that's art. No. Maybe it's art, but you know. But just saying it is doesn't make it art. The Hindu definition, or the Sanskrit, translates to a station that one goes to feel the shock of awe. Well, if that's a good definition, and that comes from not hundreds of years, but thousands of years of human consciousness, so we've got to give it at least a little consideration. If that's a definition, then we are not living in a golden age. It seems like right now, if it's not political, for instance, I mean, that seems to be what's going on right now is politics. You know, what does the thing mean politically? And Agnes Martin used to say that the political response is the absolute opposite of the aesthetic response. I suppose you could quote that to some people, and they could say, oh, well, she was crazy, so what difference is it, what she says about anything, like, you know, only if they disagree with her.
I was looking at some of your work, and it, for me, and this I kind of, it kind of goes back to the definition you just gave from the Hindu. When I first looked at it, it seemed almost like photography. Mm. And then as I looked at it, it was super real, where it was beyond just the normal that you would take in from what you were looking at if you were just looking at the scene in nature. Mm. To me, it was and I had that shock where I went, my God, how did you get to that point?
And why did he bother? Yeah. I accept that as a compliment. Salvador Dali thought that the more a thing looked like a photograph, the better it was. Of course, he probably said that to aggravate people.
I think your strokes have a lot of infinity.
I'll try to keep that in mind.
Stretch.
Well, you know, you say infinity. Well, you know, who was that crazy English poet? William Blake. He said that if we could but cleanse our eyes, we would see what it is that is reality. We would see infinity. If we could but cleanse our eyes. And, you know, he also said thing about the grain of world being in a grain of sand and heaven in a flower. He must have been quite a guy. You know, he had a really pretty dark vision of humanity. He said in one of his poems, I walk down chartered London streets, down to where the chartered Thames does flow, and I see in every face I meet the mark of weakness, the mark of woe.
That's pretty heavy.
Yeah, it's pretty heavy, really. But he also seemed to, you know, get a big kick out of things, too. You know. Well, he did, you know. He was a real eccentric. He and his wife both. But English people love eccentrics. Just like people around here, you know, we seem to value our eccentrics here in Santa Fe.
Yeah, there might be one or two.
Yeah. People, you know, work at it.
That's the end of part one of our interview with artist and Galisteo resident Woody Gwynn. Part two will be posted tomorrow. You can support Radio Free Galisteo at www.patreon.com/Radio Free Galisteo. For Radio Free Galisteo, I'm John Shannon.